One thing my dad taught me was how to shop for a deal. Get a good product at a good price. Today, lots of Americans shop for a good deal, but not necessarily for themselves. They want a good deal for workers, for the environment, for other factors. There are a lot of names, but for today, we'll call them socially conscious consumers. Who are they, and what implications might there be for farmers, businesses, and the rest of the consuming public? That's our subject this week on Town Hall Ohio.
This is Town Hall Ohio, home to interesting people, engaging issues, and enlightening stories. Town Hall Ohio is a production of the Ohio Farm Bureau Federation, working to forge a partnership between farmers and consumers, and is supported by Nationwide. Nationwide is on your side. Now, here's Town Hall Ohio host, Joe Corneli.
Buying with a conscience. What's that mean? Who's doing it? How might the trend impact all of us? Today, we have a couple of sociologists join us to help us figure it all out. Tim Bartley is an associate professor at Ohio State University. Paul Dean has the same role at Ohio Wesleyan University. And among many duties, both of these gentlemen study and help explain this growing link between buying stuff and trying to do good at the same time. Tim, Paul, welcome to Town Hall Ohio.
Thanks, Joe.
Thanks for having us, Joe.
Glad to have you guys in. I'm looking forward to learning a lot here over the next hour. Tim, let's maybe start with you. I tried to lay out just very basically what a socially conscious consumer is, but tell us more.
Well, I think consumers across the country and really across the world have started to realize, especially in the last 20 years or so, that the cheapest product may not be the best product from the perspective of respecting the rights of workers, protecting the environment, and even having a safe product. And so there's been a growing attempt to essentially vote with your dollars and to try to use your purchases in the marketplace to promote social responsibility, to promote sustainability, and to promote product safety by companies in the market.
So, Paul, as you look at these folks, expand maybe a little bit on what Tim said about their goals and their beliefs, their values.
Yeah, I think in our everyday lives, we all try to be good moral people and make ethical decisions, but we sometimes don't necessarily always think about where our products come from and make the connection between what we consume and the workplace standards that went into it, the environmental impact that it might have. When I go back home to where I'm originally from, which is Western New York State, and a big farming community there, my father-in-law was a dairy farmer much of his life. And I ask him, you know, what do you think of this idea of socially responsible consumerism? And he says, well, I think it means something like buying American. And that's what I hear from a lot of people back there in that community. And so when people say that, I ask them, well, what about buying American is socially responsible? Because for some people, I think they take that for granted. And I like to get to the bottom of that. And what people often get to is this idea of values. So under what conditions were the workers in when they were producing it? Did they have a safe working environment? Was there a good environmental system in place? And so socially responsible consumers think about that not just in an American context, but maybe also in a global context for products that we're perhaps divorced from in the market because we don't necessarily think where they come from.
So, guys, am I wrong when my picture of the socially conscious consumer starts with him or her being young?
You're not wrong. People from across the age range do this. The research that my colleagues and I did looking at socially responsible consumers are people that say that they've purchased something for a political or an ethical or an environmental reason suggests it's kind of in the 30 to 40 range that people are most likely to do this. But certainly young people, especially in the past decade or so, have been maybe the most excited about this idea of changing the world through your purchases.
What are some of the other demographics of this consumer?
Yeah, so I think there's often a stereotype that it's only people who are really wealthy who kind of have the luxury of voting with their dollars or of expressing their values in the marketplace. And, you know, there's a little bit of truth to that. So there is some link between income and the chance of engaging in this kind of conscientious consumption. But it's actually pretty small difference between people from kind of middle class or mid-level incomes and slightly higher level incomes in terms of their likelihood of doing this.
A related factor to that would be education, too. It tends to be that people with higher levels of education tend to get exposed to these kinds of questions, either through schooling or through the social networks that they're a part of. And so as they get introduced to this idea, they start asking more questions and then start integrating that into their purchasing habits.
The other big one that seems to be true in the U.S. and in other countries as well is that women actually are more likely to do this than men are. The women, at least in terms of when asked by survey researchers, have you bought products for political, environmental, or ethical reasons, women are quite a bit more likely to say yes to that than men have. And there are a bunch of sort of speculations about why that might be the case.
So, Paul, you mentioned something that I wanted to follow up on, the social networks. We've got this technology now where the entire world can know what I'm thinking in less than about the amount of time it takes me to type in 140 characters on my telephone. So did technology enable a more socially conscious consumer group, or is it a byproduct of that? Chicken and egg, which one came first?
That's a good question. I think we really saw the rise of this in the 1990s, which was probably facilitated in part by the internet, but came about far before some of the social media technologies that we have that really are harnessing this. Now we have apps on our phone that you could scan a barcode and it immediately pulls up information and tells you the environmental impact, the worker record of that company. So I think it's a little bit of both. Certainly, as people have learned about the conditions through which production is happening and labor rights abuses or environmental abuses, they've been able to spread that message with technology, but now technology is really driving it, in a much more intense kind of way.
Yeah, I think just to pick up on that, you know, it's much easier now for people to learn about global industries and learn about what working in a factory is like, whether it happens in Ohio or elsewhere in the U.S. or somewhere else in the world, to learn about farmers' situations in very different parts of the world. So there's no doubt that that makes it sort of, that raises people's consciousness about these kinds of issues. On the other hand, in the late 1890s, from about the 1890s into the early part of the 20th century, the National Consumers League ran something called the White Label, which was one of the first consumer labels sort of geared toward helping consumers express their conscience in the marketplace. It was focused on tenement sweatshops in New York, and there was an attempt to promote the so-called White Label as that was attached to garments that had been made in healthful and decent conditions instead of in the worst sweatshop conditions. So this is not entirely new, but there's no doubt that it can happen on a bigger scale now than it could 100 years ago or even 30 years ago.
Dr. Tim Bartley of Ohio State University, Dr. Paul Dean of Ohio Wesleyan University, sociology professors, and helping us look at the concept of socially conscious consumerism. Where would you put on the level of motivation, Tim, political beliefs and values and how that impacts? Are conservatives as likely to act this way as liberals?
So it turns out the answer is yes, at least when you ask the question in terms of do you engage in socially conscious consumption, or whatever that means to you. So it turns out that both Democrats and Republicans are about the same in terms of their likelihood of doing it. They're probably focused on different issues and maybe making different choices on that basis. The other thing that does matter, though, is interest in politics. So people who express greater interest in political issues in general are also more likely to engage in this kind of conscientious consumption. So by some accounts, this is kind of just another way, another form of political expression, not through the ballot box, but through the marketplace, or a way of voting with your dollars rather than just voting with your vote.
Another place where that political background comes into play, too, is in social responsible investing, which we could debate on whether or not that's immediately what we're talking about here. But in terms of...
We got an hour. Go right ahead.
All right. Then I'm doing it. In terms of if you want to put your money in a place, not just in terms of your consumption, but where your retirement accounts are or where your investments are, in a place that matches your values, then you have a lot of options there, too. So you could purchase socially responsible mutual funds, for example. And in those mutual funds, you can essentially pay a third party who's going to evaluate if a company sort of matches your values or not. And there are mutual funds that span the political spectrum from conservative or liberal or orientations, covering even, you know, pro-life or pro-choice. I mean, sort of all kinds of things. And people are really able to try to express their values, and depending on the investor's motivations, to try to shape what those companies actually do.
So some of these things that you gentlemen have talked about, whether it's labor standards or environmental protections or beliefs and values, we have a system, not just in America, but worldwide, of regulatory oversight by governing bodies, whether it's government and primarily government. So do we view this political activism by how you spend your money as a complement to or an alternative to regulation of what we do?
It's a big question. It's a big question for sociologists in this area. You know, I think it's pretty clear that the reason that we have so many eco labels and social labels and sort of attempts to get consumers to act responsibly is because people have come to the conclusion that governments are not actually regulating industries very effectively, especially on an international scale. So it's sort of because of this problem that we have in global industries, but really only national governments, that people have turned to activists, have turned to the marketplace and tried to set standards that companies could maybe voluntarily adopt. And, you know, I think there are similar rationales within the U.S. as well, arguments that environmental regulation has not actually been as effective as it was intended to be, and that maybe action promoted by consumers and companies can get further. On the other hand, so I think we wouldn't have these programs if not for a belief that government was failing. On the other hand, it's pretty clear when you look at how these programs actually work and what a set of standards supported by a consumer actually means on the ground in a farm in Brazil, in a factory in Bangladesh, or a farm in California for that matter, that these kinds of standards work best when they're combined with government action, when they are complements in the sense that you described.
Some people will purchase, will become a socially conscious consumer really for their own individual interests and sort of to appease their kind of own conscience. But for the people who see it as something more than that, who want to use their dollars to engage the world, to change the world, I think this is the most fundamental question. And just to reiterate what Tim had said, you know, really it's the question is there a difference? Is there a difference being made in terms of how companies are actually performing? And the short answer, to paraphrase Tim a little bit, is that if we were to rely only on these mechanisms as a replacement, we're not going to see the kinds of changes that we want.
You hit one of the key questions I want to get to here in a little bit. Does it work? And we're going to explore that and other subjects of social conscious consumers. Tim Bartley of Ohio State University, Paul Dean of Ohio Wesleyan. They'll be back right after this.
How much am I responsible? Can I help things to change? I'm a member of this country. But what does that mean? And how much are you responsible? Can you help things to change? You're a member of this democracy. What does that mean?
Well, we're getting answers to what it means today with Paul Dean of Ohio Wesleyan and Tim Bartley of Ohio State, both professors of sociology, helping us to understand the mindset of the socially conscious consumer and how that impacts on the marketplace. You spent a good amount of time helping us understand why people behave the way they do, buying with a conscience, using their dollars to perhaps change the world. But there's got to be some problems. And you touched on cost. As an exaggeration in the food industry, you can probably go out and buy eggs that were laid by a free-range chicken, no growth promotants in any of the feed that went into that chicken, picked up by the farm wife and kissed gently before the egg was laid in the basket. and you spend $3. Me, I want 89-cent eggs. Price has got to be one of the factors that would impede, I would think, voting with your wallet.
There's no doubt that's true for some products. And that's one of the reasons people sometimes point to this as kind of a something that only people with extra income can afford to do. And there's certainly truth to that. You know, some consumers say, well, it's worth it to me to spend a little bit more on a product that I feel good about. And for some products, at least, maybe a product that not only is more sustainable or fair, but also healthier in the case of at least some kinds of organic food. And, you know, I think that the other trade-off that people make or the other rationale is that although that $3 may be a lot more than the 99-cent eggs, it's actually a pretty small difference in the scheme of things when you think about how much people are paying for housing, health insurance, cars, and so on. So, you know, many of the products that we're talking about are more expensive, but not that much more expensive. But the other thing I think is worth saying is that in some cases, people are able to express their values through the marketplace without spending more. Sometimes it's a matter of simply avoiding a company that's been accused of unethical dealings and going for a similar product at a similar price point. In other cases, you can actually express values through the marketplace and save money. So the example I often turn to is beef and meat eating. So I eat meat. I just had a steak last night. I like to eat beef occasionally, but I know that eating meat and eating beef in particular is environmentally harmful. It contributes to greenhouse gas emissions. It contributes to the loss of land for small farmers in various countries around the world. And so I try to eat a little bit less meat than I would otherwise. And it turns out that that's also an economical choice. So you can eat, various kinds of other fibers and beans and so on. You could become a partial, sometime vegetarian and actually save money at the same time that you're expressing your values.
Just so you know, you made our vegetable producers who are Farm Bureau members very happy. Probably going to get a call from the Beef Council. I just thought I'd throw that out there. Your thought on this price as an impediment to being a more socially conscious consumer?
I agree with everything that Tim just said. And I would add to that that when we have a social relationship attached to the things that we buy, and it's not just about the price, we tend to be willing to spend a little bit more. So if we participate in perhaps a purchase for fair trade, and I suppose we'll be getting to that here soon enough, but fair trade is one of the kinds of products that is widely available in terms of these socially responsible or socially conscious decisions. And if you buy a bag of fair trade coffee at the store, it is going to be a little bit more for a pound. It's probably going to be a few bucks more. But through that packaging, what fair trade marketers hope to do is to create a relationship between you and the grower. So we don't grow coffee here in the United States, but lots of countries do. And through that packaging, marketers hope to create a relationship there in which people will be interested in more than just the price. And so we find that's the case with a lot of products that people are willing to make that kind of trade-off.
So as a capitalist, I kind of think it's a good idea for the market to drive what's available for me to buy, and I believe in competition. Is there a risk that if we start sending new signals to that marketplace that we could lose some of the gains? The gains we've had from technology, the gains we've had from trade, I'm not saying they're 100% great, but if we start using a whole different metric for producers to read consumers, do we run the risk of losing some of these gains we've made?
It's an interesting question. I don't think so. You know, I think that companies can adapt to changing consumer tastes pretty effectively. They do it all the time when it comes to media, TV shows, and movies. They adapt to changing consumer tastes all the time. When it comes to clothing, cars, companies seem to have no problem adapting to what consumers would like them to do. No problem might be overstated, but they get the hang of it. And so, you know, if this is a set of consumers that companies value, then I think they'll figure out ways to provide products that at a reasonable price that speak to those consumers' interests without completely reversing the course of the economy.
We've just got a quick moment here. Do we have an idea how big of a piece of the marketplace the socially active consumer is?
It depends on the product. So probably the clearest case is where there are lots of consumers interested and lots of companies interested in serving them are things like organic food, where I couldn't tell you the percentage of the market that organic agriculture is, but certainly for some fruits and vegetables, it's a sizable portion. And the number of consumers that are interested in organic food has gone up dramatically. For energy efficient appliances, there are lots of appliances with Energy Star labels and so on. So for at least a couple of these, they're quite significant size segments of the market.
More on voting with your wallet with Tim Bartley and Paul Dean when we continue.
Some have maxed out all their credit cards. Some are working two jobs and living in cars. Minimum wage won't pay for a roof, won't pay for a drink. If you gotta have proof, just try it yourself, Mr. CEO. See how far 5:15 an hour will go. Take a part-time job at one of your stores. I bet you can't make it here anymore.
When we go to the store, when we go to the market, do we buy simply because we want a product or because we want to change the world? That's kind of where we're going today with the subject of socially conscious consumers, dissecting how they think, how they act, and what it means to all of us. Tim Bartley from Ohio State University and Paul Dean from Ohio Wesleyan. I want to drill down into a few of the products that where this manifests itself. And Paul, a few moments ago, you used the term fair trade. You were referencing coffee. Tell us more about what the fair trade concept is.
Yeah, so fair trade is a certification for a variety of products, and there's dozens of products that it includes. Coffee's the biggest one, but chocolate, bananas, quinoa. You can even get fair trade vodka in some places. So there's a lot of different things you can get. But basically, how it works is that there's an independent agency that certifies whether or not a producer meets certain standards. And those standards might include workplace practices and safety, levels of compensation, environmental impacts, gender equity, and a number of factors. And the exact standards vary from commodity to commodity, but they're created through a sort of coalition of local community organizations and producers, as well as other consumers interested in the market. And so it's created together as a group, and it's enforced by a third party so that you know as the consumer that that product is going to meet a certain set of standards.
So I learned there's fair trade vodka. I have to look that up a little bit more. The one you hear it attached to the most, at least I do, Tim, is fair trade coffee. Yeah. You've studied that.
Yeah, so the reason that it started with coffee is sort of an interesting story that I think is relevant to farmers around the world, which is in the 1980s, when the commodity agreement that had regulated and stabilized the price of coffee globally, when that fell apart, when that was dismantled, the prices that farmers were receiving for their coffee beans just plummeted. And these were farmers that were already living kind of close to the edge of subsistence, and many were driven into extreme poverty. And it was at that point, actually, that they teamed up with some activists in the U.S., some activists in Europe, and created this idea of fair trade, which, in addition to doing all the things that Paul talked about, provided them with a decent price and a stable price for their coffee. And it was actually a really important, I think, response to that moment. And that's why it started with coffee. And then since then, it's expanded to other products, as Paul mentioned, including things like chocolate, where conditions in the non-fair trade part of the industry, conditions in sort of the regular part of the chocolate industry can be really extremely dire, involving essentially new forms of slavery and child slavery in the production of chocolate.
So help me understand where social consciousness comes in the electronics industry, Paul. What are people thinking about there when they decide whether to buy a Droid or an iPhone?
Well, one of the things that we know from the production of iPhones, and because it's a commodity that is widely available, so many people recognize it. We've had a lot of people doing research on this, and Apple has a very complicated supply chain where parts come from around the world. But basically, your iPhone is most likely going to be assembled in China by a subcontractor named Foxconn. And Foxconn factories in and of themselves are cities. They tend to employ thousands and tens of thousands of workers in a single factory. And the labor conditions that we found happen there to put together your iPhone tend to be pretty bad. They include things like forced overtime, substandard wages that are way below what it costs to survive. It's led to even protests from within factories themselves, to the point of actually suicides happening by workers as an act of protest against the labor conditions. So these are the kinds of things that people have identified as being problematic about the iPhone.
So we'll jump around a little bit here, and we've only got about a minute and a half. What Paul just described is not attractive, and yet Apple is selling a ton of iPhones, and the next generation is the prospects of its raising Apple's price of stock.
Most profitable company in the world.
What's up with that?
I think we've been seduced by the allure of gadgets, and we've forgotten the concrete people that produce them. And it's not that the iPhone is just spit out by a machine. There are people polishing the screens of our iPhones before they come to us. And often that's been done with highly toxic materials that have led to all sorts of health problems, in addition to the other conditions that Paul talked about. We forget that as we get attracted to new gadgets and new apps. And so I think one of the things that this conscientious consumption movement has done is try to remind people of the real people behind their products. The other side of the electronics equation is, once we get rid of phones and other electronics, they often end up causing serious harms as well through the export of electronic waste, again, to people in places that are quite vulnerable and don't have technological capacities to deal with it safely.
A great conversation on spending with a conscience. Tim Bartley of Ohio State University, Paul Dean of Ohio Wesleyan University, helping us understand the whys, wheres, and hows of this practice. We'll be back with more on Town Hall Ohio right after this.
I'll make the difference. I'll say what this is.
We're talking this week on Town Hall Ohio how you might choose to make a difference in the world with how you spend your hard-earned money. Dr. Tim Bartley and Dr. Paul Dean. Tim is at Ohio State. Paul is at Ohio Wesleyan. And we're talking about the idea of spending your money, being a socially conscious consumer. We've touched on the electronics industry and a little bit about food, but the apparel industry too. That seems to be one that motivates people to try to spend wisely.
That's right. And you know, as Paul mentioned earlier, one of the ways that people have sometimes thought about expressing their values in the marketplace is to do things like Buy American. If you try to do that for clothes, you're not going to be wearing very much. It's quite hard to find clothes made in the U.S. Maybe that's getting a little bit easier in the last few years, but still, most of our clothing is made in Southeast Asia, in China, in Bangladesh, in India, Pakistan, and a few other countries. And so there have been a lot of concerns over the past 15 years or so, in particular, about the conditions of the people that make our clothes, how they're treated, the kind of wages that they get, and whether they're ultimately respected as working people should be.
A lot of stuff here I'm learning and very interested in. Paul, you told me that Ohio Wesleyan, you do a lot of teaching. How do the kind of things that you and I and Tim are talking about today resonate with those 18, 20, 22-year-olds that you're trying to help broaden their vision?
Well, students have been immersed in a consumer society in which much of their identity, I think, is built around the kinds of things that they've consumed. And I think that there's a lot of dangers to that. But students, these questions, I think, really, really resonate with students because it's so tangible to their everyday lives. And they see people wearing logos and consuming certain kinds of things every day. And so these things are particularly things that speak to their immediate reality.
That's Paul Dean of Ohio Wesleyan, Tim Bartley of Ohio State's in. Tim, just real quick, I didn't get a chance to go. I was tied up, but you gave a presentation to the Ohio Environmental Professionals Network a little while back. It dealt with green labels. So what do people really know when it says organic, GMO-free, natural, fresh from the farm? Are those labels really telling us anything?
It's hard to know because there's so many labels, and it's hard to keep up with what they mean and whether they're credible. So this is a general problem that consumers face. You know, the biggest ones are things like organic labeling, and one of the initiatives that I focused on, which is labeling of wood and forest products, wood and paper products, by a group called the Forest Stewardship Council, or the FSC. You might see it on paper bags and on other paper products. And there are a few different labels, but not quite so many. And consumers can at least press for some improvements by looking for products that have those labels.
Paul, your thoughts on labeling. Are we susceptible to being misled because we want to be doing the right thing?
There's always a danger of that. Anytime there are certain buzzwords that if you see them, you should question. So example, natural. If you see the word natural, you should say, well, what exactly does that mean? Because it doesn't have...
It's not unnatural.
It's not unnatural, but it might be problematic. And it doesn't have the same kind of specific requirements behind it like, say, organic. When you buy organic, you're pretty much assured. I mean, there's some problems in that industry too, but you have a guarantee that it's going to meet at least certain things. And so we have to look for those kinds of cues to look for. But I got to say, I have spent years researching this, maybe not as long as Tim has, but I still have trouble keeping up with all these things. So I really have a lot of empathy for people who struggle through that.
You know, when I made this presentation at the Environmental Professionals Network, the other person who presented that day was from the Federal Trade Commission. And she's part of a division that tries to essentially keep an eye on the various words like natural and labels that are going on products and tries to keep companies honest. But she admitted, you know, their agency doesn't have a lot of resources to actually do that. Mostly they rely on being able to persuade companies not to use them instead of having a lot of enforcement power. So it's a real problem that continues.
We've only got a minute here, so we're not going to get to all of this, but I want to start the conversation. We've been talking about the consumer and the demand. What about the supplier? What's happening in the supply side of the chain of commerce? Are these kind of demands from consumers, Paul, starting to impact what's available on our shelf?
Well, let me start by talking about the segment as the conventional. Usually suppliers are pinched to cut their costs as much as possible. And when they do that, they're gonna cut corners around environmental impacts or worker protections. And that's going to be a problem for any industry. So what socially responsible consumption tries to do is to put pressure on the consumer-facing brands that will then have that impact the suppliers. And in some cases, we see some changes, but it's no replacement for enforceable requirements.
We're going to follow up on this "is it working" question when we continue on Town Hall Ohio. Doing what's right when you spend your money to influence social issues. That's our subject today with Dr. Tim Bartley of Ohio State University and Dr. Paul Dean of Ohio Wesleyan. We're talking about socially conscious consumers. So, Paul, I kind of had to force you to talk in a very brief amount of time about a big question. So we've got this movement where consumers want to change the way business practices are handled. You've got a business trying to decide whether or not they want to make money and can they make money under the new demands. Is it working? Do we know that a semi-unorganized social movement can make megacorp change the way they do business?
Well, one thing we said in the break was that it's probably easier to come up with examples where it's not making much of an impact than where it is. You know, one area that that has been particularly problematic is in the area of fast fashion, where suppliers are being forced to cut their costs so quickly for outlets like H&M, where you have this rapid cycle of clothing and at an incredibly affordable cost. And sometimes when you get something at such a great price, you kind of have to wonder, is this business just really that good and they're the best business, or are they cutting corners? I think one place where it has been a little bit more effective, to go back to one of our examples from earlier, is in the coffee sector, which has a much longer history, and we've seen more gains in fair trade coffee. That's not to say the same across all products that are certified fair trade, which is one of the ways in which this area is complicated, but we've definitely seen good gains there.
Yeah, so farmers producing for the fair trade system, there's lots of evidence that they have better livelihoods. They're able to manage the land a little bit in a little bit more sustainable way. It's not a perfect system, but compared to the mainstream coffee market, they're certainly doing better. You know, the H&M is a really interesting example because they, at the same time that they're promoting fast fashion and cheap products, they have a really extensive set of rules for their suppliers around the world to follow. Pertaining to labor conditions, worker safety, respect for labor rights. And companies that run apparel factories in China and Bangladesh, in Pakistan and so on, they are doing things in response to that. In some cases, they're making production process a little bit safer. They're training managers to not be so harsh in their treatment of workers. And yet, those same managers have to figure out how to produce very, very quickly at a very, very low price, and you can imagine who ends up bearing the brunt of that. So for every bit of change, there seems to be a lot of the same thing, driven largely by price pressures.
So I started off the show, Paul, saying Dad taught me how to get a good deal. What if I want to expand my thinking? What if my idea of a good deal isn't just a good product, get a good price, but I want to make sure that the workers that raised it, that made it, were treated fairly? I want to make sure that there was a very small, manageable environmental footprint. Besides just simply opening my eyes, how do I get started? Where do I educate myself to become more socially conscious?
Well, there are apps that you can get for your phone, and there are sort of buying guides.
Make it easy.
There you go. One of them is called Good Guide. There's responsible shopping guides online that you can go to from places like Co-op America. So there's a number of resources there where you can start to really weed through some of the requirements and kind of begin to understand what's just sort of window dressing and what actually will mean something.
I think you can also just slow down your purchases. So, you know, the problems of fast fashion that Paul described are also the problems of fast electronics. And a lot of the both environmental and labor violations around the world are driven not just by pressure for low prices, but this like very, very rapid change in the styles of products, which leaves companies and workers scrambling to keep up and cutting lots of corners along the way. So holding on to our phones a little bit longer is not a bad thing to do, making sure they're disposed of responsibly once you do move on to a new model. Holding on to your clothes a little bit longer, even if it means you're not completely up to date with the latest in the fashion trends, can be, I think, a responsible consumer behavior.
So we appreciate your time. And real quick, we said earlier it's hard to tell exactly how much of the marketplace is behaving in this way. Do you sense that it's growing, though? Do you think more people are becoming aware?
There's no doubt that, especially over the last 20 years, that's been the trend. Whether that will continue or whether it's kind of hit a peak, I don't know.
Well, we'll have you back in 20 years and ask that question again. Dr. Tim Bartley of Ohio State, Dr. Paul Dean of Ohio Wesleyan are guests this week on Town Hall Ohio.
Town Hall Ohio is a project of the Ohio Farm Bureau Federation and is brought to you with the support of Nationwide. Nationwide is on your side. Join us again next week for Town Hall Ohio.